I've been on the planet as a salient being for more than 70 years, but never experienced summer heat and drought like last year's, nor a winter like the last few months of nearly continual rainfall. What I found astonishing how little the fact of climate change has entered our national conversation. One respondent to one of my tweets captured the prevailing mood. It simply said, "It's winter, it rains, get over it." Yet the evidence is ubiquitous and global. It could be record-breaking wildfires to catastrophic floods. Climate disasters are killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. An estimated 250 million people flee from their homes because of climate change. Yet in 2024, average global temperatures were 1.6 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial averages against a target of 1.5 degrees. And there's every expectation that more years will follow like that. Life as we know it's at stake. So why aren't we moving faster? What's holding back the systemic shifts needed to avoid disaster? Professor Tim Lenton is one of the world's leading climate scientists tackling exactly that question, but with a different twist. He's Professor of Climate Change and the Earth System Science at the University of Exeter and founding director of the Global Systems Institute. He's renowned for his pioneering work on climate tipping points, critical thresholds in the Earth system that once crossed can trigger dramatic and irreversible change. But the opposite can also be true. More recently, his research has focused on positive tipping points, how rapid, self-propelling shifts in technology, economics, and social behavior could accelerate climate action. His work shows that change does not always move slowly. Under the right conditions, it can cascade. Tim's research and latest book on positive tipping points in the climate tell a more hopeful story, one in which shifting and adjusting our lifestyles can create a positive ripple of change and steer us away from the current trajectory of climate disaster. Professor Tim Lenton, it's great to have you on the podcast. When you hear me introduce you like that, what are your reactions? Have I got it right? Have I described your kind of approach to this correctly? Or have I overdone it, undersold it, oversold it?
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. Well, I always feel bad about being this Cassandra or Horseman of the Apocalypse figure. And I did it partly for my own sanity to see if I could convince myself that there was a credible way out of trouble. Because if you just stare at the horror show of escalating climate tipping points, it can be challenging to get out of bed in the morning. But us scientists are born optimists, I think, because we love nature and that's why we chose to study it. Something about that, I think, carries us through, you know?
I want to get to the substance of your book, obviously, but I detect a bit of weariness more generally about making the case for climate change. Yet, you know, the last 12 months, the summer was astonishing. Drought, heat, brown fields everywhere. Golf courses like concrete, baked hard. And the last few weeks, the last few months, you know, from mid-November right through to the end of February, I can't remember a period of months like it. And yet you can't get a conversation off the ground about the jet stream has moved, the pattern of fronts is consequently different. This has lived climate change. I mean, no one seems to want to hear about it.
We're fickle creatures, aren't we? And we blow a little bit with the winds of social political context, I fear. But I think there is still traction, at least if we were to believe the many, many surveys and polls that are continually done, which repeatedly tell us that worldwide, 75 or 80% of people recognise as urgent issue of climate change and that government should be doing more about it. I'm as puzzled as you are the way the narrative discourse is being captured by what I see as a small fraction of vested interests. But then I go and chat to my brother-in-law who's a farmer, and there's no questioning that the climate's changing. If you, like he does, live and work outside, people like that are knocking down my door anyway, saying, "What on earth is going on? This is crazy," as you said. What we sometimes refer to as global weirding of the weather. I mean, we're just seeing unprecedented extremes already, and you have to have your head pretty deep in the sand not to sort of recognise that.
Yeah. Why has it been so wet this winter?
That's a great question. But what we've seen, for example, is an odd scenario where, because I'm down in the southwest where it really has been really wet, we had what's called a blocking of the jet stream, something we're more familiar thinking about in the summer when it would lead to a persistent heat wave, a persistent blocking high pressure. In this case, the position of the blocking high and the low was such that it was funneling very moist air consistently for a long time, especially onto the southwest of England. And was the point about a blocking event is it refuses to budge. So the weather systems don't keep shifting around as they usually would. But we may, you know, as we continue to talk, we might be able to tease out how these kind of changes in the behavior of the jet stream can in turn be affected by changes in the circulation of the Atlantic and the North Atlantic Ocean. And that's one of our big concern areas for tipping points, that if we cross them, are really going to have big impacts on the UK.
Just unpack that for us.
So where the jet, so that's this jet of air, if you like, blowing west to east across the Atlantic, where it is, whether it's really strong and hammering us or whether it's meandering around, its position, these things are partly sensitive to like the temperature of the surface of the ocean, especially as you get sort of up to the latitudes we're at, comparable latitudes across south of Greenland. You've got a patch of surface ocean. Actually, it's one of the only, well, pretty much the only part of the world where we see some cooling of the surface in a world that's warming up. That in turn is telling us, we think, something about a disruption to the transport of heat by the ocean up to the North Atlantic. In the fast timescales, if you change the surface temperature of the water that the jet, if you like, is going over, you're changing the source of energy, if you like, that can be a supply of to the atmosphere. But also, if you change the pressure difference between the sort of higher latitudes and the lower latitudes, that's setting the strength of the jet itself and can influence its position. So just giving a bit of a flavour, this stuff is all interconnected. And when it comes to bigger picture questions about, well, why do we have this really mild winter climate in the UK? After all, if you went round the planet at the same latitude and found yourself in British Columbia in Canada, you'd be expecting a pretty harsh, cold, snowy winter. And we don't have that because we have this thing we know and love as the Gulf Stream, a great current of a massive supply of warm water and heat to our little island. But our worry is that that supply of heat is ultimately under threat from a tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean circulation.
When people kind of hear things like that, you know, you just feel helpless, really. But one way out is to start thinking about working from the bottom up. There are ways in which kind of individual citizens can engage with what's happening, and in the act of engaging with it, start to create a culture in which one is, there's an expectation of governments that they should be doing more as well. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Absolutely. I'm 100% with you, Will, and that's kind of the message I'm trying to convey with positive tipping points, that yes, it's totally natural to feel kind of bamboozled by the complexities of climate change. I mean, it's like invisible gases, carbon dioxide or whatever, and they're affecting this really complicated thing that this professor on the podcast is chatting about. But my God, there's a lot to think about there. We think, oh, well, if I do something, my tiny little action can't make any difference to this enormous global complicated thing. But I want to try and convince listeners that it can, because little actions can cascade into bigger actions and bigger ones. And that's how so profound social change has always happened. So I like to kind of also refer back to famous historical examples, because I have a suffragette relative, Lillian Lenton. And so the point is, I think we can all think of examples like I grew up where the social norm was, I was in a restaurant or a pub, people would be lighting up and smoking. That was the norm. But it ain't the norm now, and we'd be appalled, and we'd abhor anyone who lit up in a restaurant or a pub, right? So norms can shift, and those can be norms around behaviours that affect the climate as well. And as you rightly said, we've all got some agency to make a difference. And my point would be, whether it's adopting like a clean technology, like I choose to put a solar panel on my roof, or I need a new car, or a second-hand car, but I buy the electric one. In so doing, adopting the clean technology, not only could I maybe influence other people to adopt it if I decide it's good, but actually by adopting it, I activate what is happening in technology innovation, which is making the thing cheaper and more attractive and more accessible for the next person to adopt. So the more of us who make the change, the more we encourage others to make the change. That's in all sorts of ways, through all sorts of what I would talk about as amplifying feedbacks.
There's a couple of examples there. I mean, buying an electric car makes a difference, not just yourself. Mm. The range is really 500 miles or more is not unusual now for sort of better electric cars, isn't it?
Yeah. And the thing is, that range has gone up nearly a factor of 3 in a decade. That is spectacular learning by doing, as we call it, from innovation. So suddenly it's a way more attractive proposition, right, to adopt the car now because you don't have the range concern you had before. Equally, the price is coming down all the time. The price of the batteries has been the big issue that's been making the electric vehicle more expensive. But the price of batteries just last year, from 2024 to 2025, dropped 20% across the global market, 30% in the Chinese market. In the long run, it certainly fell by a factor of 10 in a decade. And this means you just project forwards. They're going to be cheaper to manufacture in all markets soon, and then they'll be cheaper to buy eventually in all markets. It's just some markets have got there sooner, China being a great example. And it's a huge deal because about 13% of greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change come just from road transport, and that's dominated by cars, plus all the deaths from air pollution from the what's coming out of the exhaust of the petrol or diesel car.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, the next car I buy will be either electric or, say, a hybrid, no question. And actually, you're right. I mean, it's cheap. And that's the thing that I find it so frustrating for those of us who spend a few minutes just studying the Chinese economy, successfully staved off deindustrialization and to an extent has reindustrialized. How's it done it? It's done it off dirt cheap renewables, in particular solar energy, and then its commitment to lithium batteries, electric car manufacture, that has become a kind of a critical part of its economy.
Yeah, you nailed it. And China, just last year, although they continue to have spectacular growth in demand for electricity as they continue to kind of grow, if you like, they have turned the corner where now their new installations of solar panels is outstripping the growth in electricity demand, which means they're starting to shut down coal-burning power stations. So you often hear people loosely referring to the Chinese and coal burning, and they don't realize that, as you emphasize, China's leading the world in this clean tech revolution. And there's a wonderful backstory, a further backstory about where that came from, especially for solar panels. Because it's not just
what is the backstory?
So part of the story we hear is the role, as you said, of what we'd call industrial strategy, and the government having come on board and realised it's got a massive domestic market for those, both for those panels and for those electric vehicles and batteries. The solar panel story actually starts with a bunch of what you'd call entrepreneurial researchers, almost. All of the chief technical officers all came out of the lab of Martin Green at the University of New South Wales in Australia. So a mix of Chinese and Australian researchers who'd been busy winning the prizes, by the way, for generating the most efficient solar cells most years for decades. They saw an opportunity because the Chinese economy was starting to liberalize, and Germany at that time had created, if you like, a market to sell solar panels into because a combination of the new Green Party, I think Social Democrat Coalition, was pushing, they're putting forward a feed-in tariff, a subsidy basically for people to put solar panels on their roofs, etc. So the first company is called SunTech, but there were several others. They start up production lines in China, these researchers from Australia, and they are selling into the German market, and they're growing rapidly as companies. And then the liberalisation of the economy means that those companies could float on international stock exchanges. So actually, SunTech was like the biggest technology float of the year when it floated on the Dow Jones. And this is the mid to late 2000s. And at that point, you get a massive injection of private capital, if you like, that really kicks off what we call the economies of scale, the plummeting price of solar. A year or two later, around 2010, the Chinese government really caught on and realized, oh, wow, this thing is happening and we can support it and we've got a massive domestic market for this. So we're going to pile in with extra support. And then, wow, the acceleration went crazy.
You mentioned your forebearer, Lilia Denton. I mean, she's a famous suffragette. You like to cite her, not only because, you know, the...
Pride, familial pride, even if it is a distant second cousin or whatever. Yeah. But
what she exemplified, yeah.
Yeah, because, wow, a few very brave people ultimately changed the nature of our democracy to such an extent that afterwards it seems almost impossible to believe it was different, right? But the episode that really stuck with me is in 1913 when Lillian and her accomplice Olive Warry were caught red-handed for burning down the tea house in Kew Gardens, one of her regular acts of arson to try to show the then government that you shouldn't be able to continue governing without the consent of half of the governed, the female half. Anyway, a routine practice as a suffragette banged up in prison was to go straight on hunger strike, which Lillian did. Routine practice for the authorities was then to force feed the hunger strikers. But in this particular instance, about 3 days into her incarceration, they put the tube down the wrong way when they were force feeding her into one of her lungs.
And drowned her, nearly drowned her.
Yeah, nearly drowned her. So that must have been excruciating. It's called pleurisy. Apparently, the reports that you can read in the National Archives show that it took 7 people to physically restrain her in this. But then what happened was authorities discreetly released Lillian from prison, not to hospital, incidentally, just to the care of her friends to recuperate after she sort of choked and survived. But the then Home Secretary, Reginald McKenna, lied publicly about what had happened, saying, oh, Miss Lenton is just ill because she was on hunger strike. And then the bastions of the establishment at the time, the opposition, but a bunch of doctors went public to the Times and other erstwhile outlets saying, this is nonsense, the Home Secretary's lying. And that was one of many episodes in that incredible saga where the general public's sympathies started to shift a bit towards the militant suffragette cause. Because, of course, they weren't popular, as I know you well know. Like any militant activists, they tend to be pretty unpopular. But, of course, ultimately, they played some key role, not the only role, but a key role in shifting to universal suffrage.
But, I mean, we're not having the same impact now. I mean, climate justice campaigners don't find themselves getting as much public support as Lillian did back in the day. I mean, although some, it has to be said, it's not a completely barren picture, is it?
No, and I think, it's one of these things where we blow one way and the other, right? Pre the pandemic, I think there was a hugely positive social movement going on, including, although some would... they made some mistakes. None of us are perfect. But the Extinction Rebellion original actions that occupied a large part of central London had a kind of party atmosphere. The government did respond to that. That did coincide with strengthening the Climate Change Act to set as a net zero 2050 target. Many people would have, I think, broadly positive feelings that young people, especially iconified by Greta Thunberg, had sort of started to call out, shall we say, some older authority figures and say, look, this is a serious issue, we need to do more. Then by chance, you might say, the pandemic hit and that put paid to a lot of things. Subsequently, what I think we've all seen is government cracking down on right to protest. I'm just kind of personally appalled. We've let that happen. We're letting the naysayers, the vested interests in the fossil fuel industry that want to maintain the status quo, rule the public discourse, which is ultimately against the public good.
Have you taken action outside the laboratory, outside your
Oh, I love your question, because I like people like me get to speak at Glastonbury Festival and the like, and the activists often ask me that there. And I have to confess that I'm really not a natural protester on the streets. I'll be frank with all listeners that for me, I'm not a person who's comfortable in a tight space with a lot of other people. I'd rather be like running around on Dartmoor on my own. So my argument is I'm trying to do my bit for the cause by providing the evidence that strengthens the argument for the activists.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters, so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday, and you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. What are the changes that you think are pivotal? I mean, electrification of the grid, electrical vehicles. Just run through them.
So, first of all, 3/4 of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the problem are coming from what we call the energy system. 1/4 from just power generation, electricity generation. So first of all, let's go to clean, green, renewable power. That then gives us a basis to electrify as much of the rest of that energy system as we can. And most activities, most end uses for energy can be electrified, including let's tackle road transport. That was 13% of emissions. Heating our homes, that's a big chunk of emissions, and heating buildings. Other forms of mobility, obviously. And then you get to a few bits of the energy system where electricity or batteries can't do it yet, whether that's flying or sending a ship a long distance over the ocean or making steel, maybe. But for those things, there's a solution. You use renewable electricity to split water to make hydrogen. We call it green hydrogen to signal it was made with renewable power. And that gives you the building block to reduce iron to make steel, or to make the chemical fuels you need, like synthetic jet fuel if you want, or ammonia can be a fuel for long distance shipping. So we know all of this is possible. We can decarbonize all of that energy system. And the further we go with each of those technologies, the cheaper and the better they get, until they become the cheaper, better, obvious option. Then there's 1/4 of emissions that are basically tied to our diet choices and the fact that that then drives land use and the net destruction of nature, including forests. And the big culprit there, in simple terms, is red meat, beef and lamb, especially grazing fed. That's just a spectacularly inefficient way to feed ourselves or to get any protein. In simple terms, for example, if you just eliminated grazing fed beef from diets worldwide, it would halve the land use from agriculture, pasture mostly worldwide. I mean, what a spectacular figure. It's that form of meat eating which is still net driving forest destruction. So if we're serious about let's stop destroying forests, let's regenerate nature, we just need to change diets a little bit to have a disproportionate benefit, to then stop making the destruction of nature release carbon to the atmosphere and instead get to a position where we can be regrowing forests or wetlands or whatever it is to suck carbon back out of the atmosphere, and nature then becomes part of the solution.
So are you a vegetarian driving an electric car?
I do have an electric car, but I'm a flexitarian. I'm not a vegetarian because I know the numbers as well, and I don't believe in a black and white version of the future. I think with diverse people, we'll have different preferences, and we would be doomed if we all had to turn vegetarian to solve the problem. And I have good reason to eat less meat in my diet, as my immediate family will attest. It's not just for the sake of the climate or nature. It's because red meat is bad for your health. And my father and my grandfather both died from colorectal cancer, which is causally connected to eating red meat. So I'm a rational, scientific being. I'm not stupid. I know what's good for my own health. So I think there's lots of, like we've been talking about, lots of these benefits align. Yeah, this is about the climate and our life support system, but it's also about basic stuff, better health, cleaner air,
yep,
cheaper electricity. Hey, what's not to like?
Well, learning much more about your family history than I expected. But look, I mean, the book Tipping Point is alerting us to wrong tipping points that have been broached, but also urging us, inviting us not to get too doom-laden by thinking of tipping points which might work the other way. I mean, what are they?
Well, we've touched on a few of them, which is the positive tipping points. As let's take an example. If I choose to buy an electric vehicle, not a fossil-fueled one, my action is going to do its little bit to make the innovation happen that makes the next vehicle that little bit cheaper, that little bit longer range, that little bit better. Equally, we've talked about diet change, and that is definitely an emotive issue. Everyone's very emotive about what they eat. It's also well shown that if more of us are shifting to eating less meat or alternatives, we positively influence other people to do so. And very basic stuff, like if you have more vegetarian options on a menu, it's proven that you get a much greater consumption of those options. So there's many ways in which by making a change, we can encourage others to join in the change. And we have what psychologists call not just individual efficacy, which is our sense that we can make a difference, but there's this thing, they label it collective efficacy, but it's the basic idea that by acting together, we feel we have more capability to create change.
That's bottom up, top down. I mean, where should resources be focused on tackling the negative impacts of climate change?
Well, first of all, the top-down policy absolutely needs to get behind phasing out fossil fuels and phasing in the clean technologies. So we have a ban on petrol and diesel car sales in our market after the year 2030, and we should hold the line on that. The more other countries that make such mandates, phase out, phase in mandates, the more effective it is at basically, you could say, forcing the hand of industry, but industry will come willingly along this journey as long as they know policies stay committed to retool the production lines and realise all of the profit as well as the clean green energy benefits in switching to selling us the clean tech rather than the dirty tech. So it's really important that policy, and we have a fantastic cross-party consensus climate change act in this country, it's vital that we don't waver on or break that consensus with the kind of crazy backsliding that we've seen going on in some political quarters of late.
Finances throughout, right? How has your research changed you? I mean, did you come to your research as a convinced of the case, or has it been something that I kind of acknowledge that as you executive research, you become more and more convinced of?
Well, when I was a teenager way back in the 1980s, and by the time I went up to university in the early 1990s, I was as well as a passionate science geek kid, I was concerned about global warming. A guy called James Hansen had testified to US Congress in 1988 about the urgency of the situation of global warming. I was concerned about the ozone hole, which was a big issue at the time. The ozone hole being discovered by the British Antarctic Survey, and we're all worried about CFCs and aerosols. And Amazon deforestation was a huge issue at the time. So it's nothing's new under the sun, as it were. So when I started my path passionate about science, it was actually reading Jim Lovelock's books on the Gaia hypothesis, the Earth as a living system, that captivated my imagination and connected, I think, with my own values, I suppose, as well as my scientific drive to want to understand this incredible Earth, this incredible life support system that's evolved over 4 billion years to create a world that we could inhabit in the first place with an atmosphere of oxygen we could breathe that's made by other life forms, a cool climate that's created by other life forms. So I come to this kind of steeped in that knowledge that we depend on this incredible, you could say, living system to be here at all, and that it was obvious to me, even as a teenager, that it was a travesty to be trashing our life support system. So when I then got into studying climate change, it's perhaps natural that I would be highlighting to everybody the risks, but also maybe it's natural that I would see that change comes from the bottom up and can change the world, because that's how life change the world. That's how some little bacteria learn to do photosynthesis and create an oxygen-rich atmosphere. We wouldn't be here without those bottom-up innovations. So that's what's going to change the world this time around as well.
Fantastic. Look, I mean, thank you so much for that. And let's hope that your words have convinced a few people that they should drive an electric car and eat more vegetables. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Will. That'll be a fitting legacy. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.